And welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today is no exception. I'm actually quite sick. I've been traveling, got back from California and Dallas with a really bad cold. I probably would have stayed in bed if it wasn't for the fact that I have the opportunity to do a podcast with Spencer Klavan. I'm going to introduce him formally in just a moment, but let me tell you a little bit about how I came into contact with his writing. A few weeks ago, my assistant came up to me and said, "You got to read this book, a book titled How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises. It is fantastic." And then a short time later, my son David said something very similar. So I started reading the book, and I loved the book. I got to a part in the book where Spencer Klavan says, "Look, I'm not trying to proselytize you to my tribe," or something of that sort. He said, "I wish everybody would join my tribe, but that's not my purpose." So I asked my assistant, "Well, what tribe does Spencer Klavan belong to?" And he said, "Well, he's Episcopalian and he's married to a man." And he said that after doing some research, because when I first asked him the question, he didn't know. Then he checked into it. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. I don't think my audience would appreciate me doing a podcast with Spencer Klavan, because I've often talked about the redefinition of marriage and many aspects that are related to the issue of sexuality, homosexuality in particular. And, you know, I certainly have a different perspective than Spencer Klavan has. So I decided the best thing to do was to talk to Spencer, and I did that. And we had a collegial conversation, and my feeling about this is that I wanted in the prologue to the podcast at least to identify the elephant in the room. But we can continue our conversation one-on-one in a different forum. This is not the forum for doing that. In this particular forum, what I want to do is talk about the brilliance of a book that I think is very worth reading. And so I'm delighted to have Spencer Klavan on the Hank Unplugged podcast. He's a scholar. He's a writer. He's a host of a podcast called The Young Heretics. He has a lifelong devotion to the great works and principles of the West. And after studying Greek and Latin at Yale, he spent 5 years at Oxford, completing his doctorate in ancient Greek literature. He now works as an editor at the Claremont Institute, which is a think tank for the recovery and preservation of America's founding ideals. He has written for many outlets, including The Atlantic, Newsweek, The Federalist, and The Daily Wire. And as I just mentioned, he's also the author of a book, How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom for Five Modern Crises. I sort of knew about Spencer through his dad, actually. I didn't really know that much about Spencer, but he's got a brilliant father who's a very accomplished writer, actor, I guess.
You'd say so?
Yeah. I mean, he's one accomplished human being. My brother kept saying, "You got to have Andrew Klavan on your podcast." But now I got the younger, smarter edition, because he's, I always say that about my son. I go, "You should be doing this podcast. You're younger, you're better looking, and you're probably a whole lot smarter than I am." But that's what we're getting today. Spencer Klavan.
I'm going to tell my dad you said that, just to rub it in.
Of course. You got to take the opportunity when you can. But no, seriously, I'm just delighted to have you on the podcast, Spencer.
Thank you, Hank. And the feeling is mutual. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for that very generous introduction and for the grace that you showed me, not only in our conversation offline, but just now. I know that, as you said, you and I have strongly differing opinions on some matters pertaining to human sexuality, and I'm sure that will be true for your audience as well. So I'm grateful to them also for their grace. And I think that it will prove warranted. I hope it will, because as you mention in the book, I say quite expressly, you know, this is not my effort to make an apologia for my personal life or to persuade you, to draw you into some program of my personal interest. It's actually just the opposite. I'm interested in my readers and in the challenges that they are looking out at. And today in America, in the West, more generally, I think we are confronted with enormous, you might call them structural problems, to use a kind of trendy word. And people, you know, when I do my podcast or when I write, you know, out online in the world, I hear from people who want very admirably and very desperately to contribute something to righting the ship, to helping solve some of these problems. How do we even think about some of these catastrophic things we see going on in the news? It seems like every day. And something that seems to me to be a problem is that when we ask that question, we think about it from the perspective of as if we were Ron DeSantis, or as if we were somebody who's tomorrow going to be charged with writing a political program that will, you know, obtain across America or change a whole state. And what happens when we think that way is despair sets in, because most of us aren't Ron DeSantis. Most of us actually are living individual lives in our communities, in our churches, in our neighborhoods. And so when we look at these giant problems that I address in the book, Crises About Religion and Where the West is Headed, and, you know, how we're going to manage our politics, I wanted to write something for the rest of us. How can we, who aren't maybe in giant positions of power or we're going to muscle the wheel of history into some new direction, how can we wake up every day and draw on the great wisdom that is handed down to us through the traditions of the West, and how can we live that out? So that's what the book's about.
Yeah, and eloquently stated. I want to talk about another crisis for just a moment, and that is the crisis imbued in the introduction to you as a person, and that is, if you and I differ, what's the crisis that is entailed by not communicating one with another?
Well, you know, as I say in the introduction to the book, I explain a little bit about the meaning of the word crisis, which is one of those ones we throw around all the time, right? We have a crisis in the supply chain. We have a crisis in our airlines right now, you know, and those may all be very serious problems. But the word crisis comes from a Greek word, krisis, with a pretty specific meaning. And that is, it's a moment of two incompatible, irreconcilable opposites or opposite options. And this is central to, for example, the Greek idea of tragedy. So you think Orestes is a man who must avenge his father's murder. The Greek mythological figure Orestes must avenge his father's murder, but his father's murderer is his mother. And it's also a moral imperative that he not do harm to his mother. And so he is caught in between the rocks of these two irreconcilable issues. And if you and I, for instance, have these disagreements, there's two possible options. Either we're in a genuine crisis, which means there is no common ground we can share. Our first principles, our premises are so radically opposed to one another that there's just no way forward for us except either violence or catastrophe. Or there is some way, some first principle that we can chase our discussion down to and proceed from there. And that's the basis of rational argument. That's how you resolve a crisis, or at least avoid a crisis, is if you can find the deeper root causes of the kind of day-to-day news cycle problems that you're having. And that's what going back to the great texts does. That's why they're there for us, is because they show us what's lying underneath these, you know, irreconcilable attitudes that we have, and help us maybe to chart a way forward.
Yeah, well said. Your book is titled How to Save the West. The most obvious question I can ask you is, how do you define the West? I find it fascinating that you have put your finger, I think, on the seminal definition of what we're talking about when we talk about the West or Western civilization.
Well, thank you. I'm humbled to hear you say that. I'm really drawing there on a philosopher named Leo Strauss, who some people really love and other people may have never heard of, but he's reaching back further, you know, behind himself as well, to this core notion of Athens and Jerusalem. And, you know, when you say the West, somebody actually, when I said I was writing a book about the West, they said, oh, I love John Wayne movies. I love spaghetti Western. And I said, that me too. But that's actually not what I'm talking about. There's all sorts of things that come up in people's minds when you say, I believe in Western civilization. As I say in the introduction, a lot of people think racist. That's just a racial chauvinist concept. You're trying to elevate Europe and white people above all other cultures. And that's certainly not true for a number of reasons, one of which is that when we use the word the West with a capital W, we're actually embracing a much broader and deeper array of history that is rooted in the intellectual and spiritual inheritance of these two great pillars of our civilization and our many societies, America included, but not limited to America. And so when we talk about Athens, what do we mean? Well, we're really rooting in Athens the pagan wisdom of Greece and Rome, the philosophy of people like Aristotle and Plato, who really, you know, peered as far as it was possible to peer, I believe, into the reaches of human reason. What can human reason uncover? And through long trial and error and wrestling with their ideas, we've inherited in the West so many wonderful concepts that stave off, for instance, you know, political catastrophe. We rooted a lot of our ideas about how to do politics together in this Athenian, Greco-Roman kind of heritage that we have. But that is only half of the picture. And sometimes I think people miss this out. You talk about Western culture, you start talking about Plato, Aristotle, that's all great. But there is a whole separate other side to that coin, and that's what's captured in the word Jerusalem. Because in Jerusalem, of course, we have the great capital of monotheism in the ancient Near East, this wild and crazy for the time idea that the Lord your God is one, that there is one God. He has a unified and unitary idea about right and wrong. Those things are absolute and objective. They don't depend on what you or I feel or think about them, and that that one God has authority over all of creation, that he created the world and continues to operate and speak in it. That's Jerusalem, which of course is passed down into the Christian faith as well in the person of Jesus and then in his disciples and interpreters and in the gospel. And these two pillars, you might say, kind of come together in miraculously almost in the Roman Empire and in its legacy in Europe. So a lot of the European countries are certainly Western countries. But one of the good things about this definition of the West is that it takes a little bit of the pressure off of us to, quote unquote, save the world, which is something you hear about all the time these days. Young kids, you know, they don't want to have children because climate change is going to destroy the world. They can't do anything before they save the world. And that leads again to that paralysis, right? But instead, what we need to understand is that we are carrying, each of us, a little light of human reason and faith. And the traditions of the West are what keeps that light burning. That's how we carry that tradition forward, no matter what may come. Because of course, the world being what it is, all sorts of terrible things may happen to us. They may not, but we need to be prepared for anything. And the way we do that is by understanding ourselves, not just as Americans, of course we are, if we are citizens of this country, not just as, you know, this or that person who lives in this city block, but as an inheritor of this vast tradition across time and space of Athens and Jerusalem.
What about the death wish on the part of many people within Western civilization for the demise of the West? You know, hey, hey, ho, ho, Western civ has got to go.
That's right. Yeah, that's the chant that, as I recall, Jesse Jackson led, which sort of precipitated a major part of the crisis of the university that we're now seeing. This idea that by schooling people in a tradition, that is the tradition of the West, the great texts of Western civilization, what you're actually doing is you're excluding people, or you're repressing them, or any number of other nasty buzzwords, right? And of course, this is exactly backwards. The way that this narrative works is it points at the people who have carried the traditions of the West forward. And then it tells whoever you're talking to, well, you don't look like that, so you don't belong in the West. They're trying to keep you out. They're trying to keep you down. The problem with this is that the great traditions of the West are the only time-tested way for blowing the lid off of all the tribalism and all of the sectarianism that is natural to man in his fallen state. I mean, this is, for us, this is the way that we see our way beyond tribalism. But, you know, during the latter half of the last century, the accusation was made, based in large part on sort of neo-Marxist ideas, that these were actually tools of oppression, tools of power to keep out certain people. And you look at our world now, which is, you know, many decades on from the beginning of that project of just shutting out the Western civilization, making us think that the West is evil and wrong and trying to deconstruct these ideas. And how's it working out for us? We have not gotten less tribalist. We haven't gotten toward this world of kumbaya where everybody can get along together because there's no evil Western oppression. In fact, we've become more tribalist. And indeed, the same left that was kicking those texts out of the universities in the latter half of the 1900s, in this century has begun to define us very much in terms of our white bodies, our black bodies, our, you know, by POC, whatever you want to call it, right? And you ask why that is. Well, it's because, in fact, we've pulled the rug. We've been spending years trying to pull the rug out from under the ideas that actually define man as soul embodied in the image of God, right? That's the idea won over long centuries. That's the idea that unites us. And without it, of course, we're going to end up in a kind of death spiral. Of course, we're going to end up, you know, refusing to have children because the world is so doomed, everything's falling apart. Of course, we're going to end up at daggers drawn because we've lost that common ground. That's what creates that crisis that we talked about at the beginning, is if you say that the only lifeline for us out of tribalism is actually just another tool of the oppressor, then you're going to end us up in a situation that looks a lot like where we are now.
Before we get into the actual crises themselves, I want you to comment a little bit about the structure of your book. I've written quite a few books myself, and I very much appreciated the way you laid out this book, where you have two chapters relating to each one of the crises.
That's right. Well, I think for me, what's key is, and this is actually something, as I say in the book, that this is a state of affairs that's represented in Plato's famous allegory of the cave, that we sort of are born into this world where these shadows kind of flicker across our vision, but we don't really see the truth. We all, I think, live in this constant social media news cycle stream, even if we don't even have a Twitter account or we're trying to, you know, keep offline as much as possible. Still, the things that, you know, go up on the news feed, the things that we talk about at the water cooler every day, it's like this stream of just thing after thing, most of them bad. And we don't really know how to make sense of them or how to unify them. And so the point of each section of the book, as you say, each section is two chapters long. And the first chapter begins with some modern things that we've all thought about. So, you know, this particular Trump scandal or that particular issue to do with transgenderism. And gradually, in the first chapter of each section, I lead you into the kind of underlying anxieties, questions, and indeed in the underlying crisis that's actually behind all of these news stories that sort of flicker across our screen, to help us kind of understand what the root questions are that we're dealing with. And that gets us into a place where, in the second chapter, then we can start to talk about the great answers of the past to these problems. Because one of the things you discover when you start to dig under this stuff is that there are really, you know, of course, we are facing unique issues with our modern technology and with the news and so forth. But underneath all that, what we're actually up against is very basic questions that have come up again and again throughout the history of the West. They're some of the core issues. What is a human being, right? What is the purpose of human life? And because they have come up so many times in the history of the West, there have been many great answers or tools for answering those questions that are on offer if we'll just look, if we'll just crack open the books which have been so maligned as evil and oppressive and racist or what have you. So, as you say, each section, there are five sections, each dealing with one crisis. And in each section, I sort of lay out the crisis, help you to see it underneath the news cycle in the first chapter. And then in the second chapter, try to offer you some wisdom from the canon for thinking about making things better in your own life.
Honestly, Spencer, I would buy this book if it were just based on the first crisis. I thought that was a brilliant first introduction to a primary crisis, the crisis of reality. And I want you to delineate for our audience what the crisis of reality entails.
Thank you. Yes, happily. So we begin in that first chapter with Mark Zuckerberg's kind of infamous announcement that he was going to rocket his company, Facebook, forward into Web3, and it was going to become Meta. And what that meant is that it was going to be a more of an immersive kind of experience where you're going to, instead of logging on and you see a screen with your friends' notifications on it, you're going to put on a headset or use some other device so that all around you, the world looks different. An ever-changing world beyond your world is waiting, is one of the advertisements that they released during this time. And you stop for a second and you realize, you know, this, of course, is the subject of like half of the dystopian science fiction that people will know about, The Matrix, right? All these comparisons have been made. And you say, well, so why, if this is supposed to be the big new thing, if this is supposed to be the next step in man's triumph over nature, we're going to, you know, sail forward into a bright future, why do I feel so queasy about it? And why do all these other authors of, you know, stories like The Matrix, or, you know, you might think of Wall-E here, or indeed the novel Snow Crash, where the word metaverse was coined, why do all these authors seem to think of this as like a dystopian and unpleasant step in the wrong direction? And what you realize then is that, of course, what we're really facing up against when somebody offers us a virtual reality headset as the key to our future is not the question, you know, whether we might like to play a video game where things kind of look like they're moving around us, but the question, what is real? What actually matters, right? Because if the only thing that's real is the thing that I can construct with my mind, can trick my senses into believing, then all sorts of nasty and unpleasant things follow. Like, for instance, you know, if the things around me are just figments of my imagination, well, then aren't you just a figment of my imagination? And isn't even my own body sort of a figment of my imagination? And why shouldn't I just reconfigure everything according to my will, my desires, my pleasure? And as you start to lay it out that way, you realize this is a very, very old proposition. In fact, it's the proposition in some ways with which Western philosophy begins, or at least Athenian Greek philosophy begins in Athens, with a conflict between Plato's Socrates. So Socrates, the great kind of barefoot teacher, and his student Plato, who wrote down kind of narrative accounts of his life and teaching and some of what it meant to him and those around him. As Plato depicts it, and this is, you know, kind of really the big bang, if you like, of Greek philosophy, there was a fundamental conflict at stake between Socrates and the other kind of professional teachers that got called the sophists. And now in our English language, we have the word sophistry, right? Which means just somebody that kind of lets off all sorts of rhetorical fireworks, but is really just selling you kind of snake oil. And that's because of Plato that we think of them that way, right? And that's the, you know, we have sophists everywhere in our society, right? Sophistry is a human perennial. In some ways, it's the natural state of thinking man. If I can think my way into arguing, or as they used to call it, making the weaker argument the stronger, well, then I can get anything I want. And what Socrates is identifying, Plato's Socrates in the dialogues is identifying, is that actually what that is it sounds sophisticated, but it's actually a recipe for violence and anarchy. And there are all sorts of episodes that I go into the book from Greek history that kind of play this out, including, not limited to, the condemnation of Socrates himself, right, as being the kind of sophist par excellence. All the people that, all the powerful power brokers in Athenian society didn't like very much that Socrates was pointing this out. He ended up being forced to commit suicide by the Athenian state. And ever since then, we have recurring throughout our history been in this battle between the sort of trendy attractiveness of relativism and the difficult but life-giving and meaning-giving issue of reality. Is anything real, whether you want it to be, whether you choose it to be, or not? And I argue in the second chapter of that section that either something is real somewhere, or we are doomed to just more of the kind of anarchic violence that you saw, for instance, under the Stalinist regime in the Soviet Union, another place that was famous for arguing that nothing is either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. And that's the question that we're confronted with. And those are our only two options.
Yeah. So if you collapse the distinction between the real and the virtual, can you then maintain a distinction between good and evil?
You know, I think a lot of people imagine that You could. It's a great question, by the way. And I suspect that, you know, somebody like Zuckerberg, in some of his public statements, which I go into in the book, you know, he starts to say, well, you'll be able to see a new reality, right? You won't just see the old reality, you also see a new reality. Or there's another person who uses the phrase reality privilege, right? You just want to stay in your world because you have it good, but shouldn't we be creating new realities in front of our imaginary world? And right, this is basically an imaginary physical reality that we're being invited to create. But the problem with this, of course, is that actually reality doesn't just stop at the physical. And you may well believe, as many people in ancient Athens did, that you can simply say, well, you know, the world that we can see and touch, that's kind of what we make of it. But we can still kind of live nice, upright, respectable lives. And basically, what I argue in the book is that this is the perennial mistake. It's kind of, you only go, it's halfway relativism. And we learn again and again that if physical reality is kind of up for grabs, is a construct purely of the human mind, then all the things that on which we base our moral reality is also up for grabs. And everything becomes kind of a struggle for power. The person who recognized this in his day, maybe unexpected kind of citation in a book like this, but the person who recognized this was Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche is somebody with whose conclusions I strongly disagree, as I imagine many people reading the book will also disagree as they read about him. And yet, what made him a visionary is that he lived also during a time when absolute truth, and specifically God, right? Specifically the conviction that there was a final arbiter of what is and is not, both in the physical and the moral sphere, right? He lived in a time when people were tossing that conviction just casually out the window, as indeed we do today, and imagining fondly that all their nice moral codes were going to stay in place. And the point of Nietzsche's famous saying that God is dead, which is in the words actually of a madman in the public square, is that the madman is the only one who can see that you can't just toss God out and not lose the entire structure, the entire civilization, the entire moral code that was built on religious beliefs and on the belief in absolute truth. Here's an easy example. You know, the brotherhood of man, right? The nice notion which you get in, for instance, the UN Declaration of Human Rights, that all men are brothers. Everybody is created equal, as we put it in this country. Well, if they're created equal, created by whom, right? And if they're brothers, then who's their father? And you realize that these things start to, in fact, break down, as they're now doing when we start to argue, well, this kind of person, it's not really a person in the womb, that's not really a person, right? We can get rid of that person if it feels good to us, if it seems necessary. And so even before the metaverse, right, long before we proposed to redefine the terms of reality using technology, we were already in this position of thinking that we could have our cake and eat it too. But in fact, the historical and the logical philosophical justification for many of our moral beliefs, the imago Dei, the common brotherhood of man created in the image of God being a classic example, is only going to last out of habit for a few generations after you toss God out. And then, as we're already seeing, it's going to start to break down. So these things are all connected. And that's something that I think we, unless we think hard about them, we sort of tend to miss.
I got to tell you, when I watch you speak, I just trip. You remind me so much of my son-in-law. He's a professor of philosophy at the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs.
Huh. Wow.
And his intellectual firepower is at a pretty high level. And when I listen to you speak, I think I'm watching him.
Wow, that's an honor. I'm touched.
Yeah, well, I have a great appreciation for people that have studied to show themselves approved and can communicate concepts in just a very articulate way.
Oh, thank you. I thought you were going to say I sounded like my dad, because the only family heirloom in our family is that every man sounds exactly the same. But that's a separate question.
But, you know, you probably suffer from a particular malady, and that's reality privilege. You actually talk about this in the book. If you prefer non-virtual life, a particular engineer was talking about, if you prefer non-virtual life over virtual reality, then you have a malady called reality privilege.
That's right. As long as we're adding to the list of available privileges, I don't see why we shouldn't throw reality privilege in there too. You've got white privilege, you've got every kind of privilege, male privilege, so on and so forth. I think I saw one article, by the way, just as a side note, that argued something like, straight black men are the white men of black people. This was like this lefty kind of social justice warrior arguing that within these communities, then you have like privilege within privilege and all these structures of oppression. So reality privilege, and this is, I think, a phrase that comes from Bo Cronin, the software developer. Reality privilege is the idea that you only resist the whole notion of virtual reality, the whole deconstruction of true and false, because things are good for you in the real world, here and now. Maybe you have a nice house, maybe you don't suffer from any illnesses, you're not debilitated in any way like that. But most people, for most of history, have had to face up to all sorts of pain and difficulty and deprivation. And so why shouldn't we just upload their consciousnesses into the cloud? Why shouldn't we just kind of inject into their brains some new idea, right, that actually everything's good? And the funny thing about this is, you know, you can take it pretty seriously, right? You can say, well, it is true, of course, that reality as we find it constituted, true and false, have all kinds of inconvenient and in some cases tragic and unfair and sorrowful consequences. And nobody would blame a person with a degenerative disease from wanting to look into technology that could heal or fix it. Of course not. That's not what we're talking about at all. But what I try to stress in the book is that the desire for there to be true and false, independent of my personal will, is actually not based on things going well or badly. It's based on wanting things to have meaning. And that is something I think meaning is a concept that we either don't pay much attention to at all, or we say we can just construct it for ourselves. But in fact, meaning is something crucial, central, core to the human person, to human life. You want it to matter when you succeed, right? And so I give in the book the example of, you know, we all know that if you play Call of Duty and you take a bullet for your buddy that's playing next to you, it's not the same thing as if you are a soldier who actually, God forbid, has to take a bullet for his buddy in real life, in meat space, as they say online. And why is that? Well, because we know that there are consequences in reality, in the real world, when we live and we operate in the parameters of true and false. And if we break down those parameters, I'm skeptical that we'll ever actually be able to do it. But if we do, if we take those barriers away, things can just be, you know, one way today and another way tomorrow, depending on how we feel. We may have gained a fair amount of pleasure, but I think we'll find that it crumbles to dust in our hands. Because what is pleasure if there's no such thing as, you know, absolutely good? It's just a kind of sensory stimulation. So yeah, I mean, like, the easy accusation is, well, you just think everything's going so well that you don't want to change, you don't want any technological development. That's not the situation here at all. What I'm trying to stress is that if you want to play the game, you have to know the rules. And if you just say there are no rules, then actually everything kind of begins to lose any significance at all. You think that's going to be fun, but after a while, it's just madness.
I want you to expand on two people that you brought up in the conversation thus far. One is Mark Zuckerberg and the other is Plato. So here's a characterization of what you say in the book, where you have Mark Zuckerberg striding like a lord among a crowd of patrons, and they have on these virtual reality headsets. On the inside, they're experiencing wonders untold. From an outside perspective, they look like people in Plato's cave. So in your metaverse experience, you feel like a superhero, but objectively, you look like you're brain dead. So expand on this in relationship to Plato's cave.
I'm really glad that you raised this, because I mentioned offhand just a moment ago that I'm skeptical we'll ever actually achieve the total breakdown of true and false, real and unreal, that we seem to kind of long for. And I don't believe it would be a good thing if we did achieve it, but I also note that never in history have these kind of pure relativist regimes ever succeeded. They always collapse under their own weight. And there's a very important reason why that I think is captured in that image, which people may have seen, the press releases of Mark Zuckerberg kind of striding through an auditorium and everybody around him is strapped into the virtual reality headset. It's not to pick on Zuckerberg particularly. I think he's a good representative of a view that obtains in Silicon Valley generally. But the thing that that photograph does is it gives us a third person view, an outside view, and it pulls back the camera, you might say, right? So let's say I'm totally immersed in my virtual reality world and everything seems great. It's still possible for those of us outside of the virtual reality world to look at people with the headset on and see a very different reality. And either that other person's idea of us, vision of us, matters, has some truth value, or it doesn't. Either other people matter and can see things that are real, or they don't. And that's another reason why virtual reality and human morality are so crucially interwoven, right? This is the point of Plato's famous cave. We've maybe all heard of this moment in Book 7 of the Republic, where Plato Socrates says, we can compare human nature in respect of education to people who are trapped at the bottom of the cave. They were born there, they're chained to the wall, and all they see are the kind of shadows projected from a fire by these little puppet masters who operate these puppets, these images of truth. And we're never quite sure, but it seems like those puppet masters are the artists in a society, the politicians, the sophists that I mentioned earlier. If we were making a modern Plato's cave, Mark Zuckerberg might be one of the people holding up the puppets, right? Or you might have the guys at Davos who are meeting to decide the fate of the world, right? These people who kind of know half-truths and they use them to deceive the masses. And what Plato's cave, again, does is it pulls back the camera and shows you that even if you completely believe what you see in front of your eyes in the cave, if you are totally immersed in virtual reality, there is a standpoint from which you are made weak and small by that exchange. Iris Murdoch, who is one of Plato's kind of modern disciples and who saw the horrors of the Nazi regime in World War II and sort of realized there must be something absolute about morality, she has this wonderful line in which she says, love and so art and morals consists in the very difficult realization that something other than oneself is real. And in some ways, that sums up everything that I'm arguing for in that first section of the book, that you cannot have the world of meaning, the world of morals, the world of love that we all know is better, is good, is better than the opposite. You can't have that world without believing that there are people and things outside of you, that you're not the only will, the only desire, the only thing that exists or matters in the universe.
One more question. I want to move on. There's so much more that can be unpacked, and you do unpack in terms of the crisis of reality. But something seminal that caught my attention in your book is the significance of the embodied life in terms of reality. And we've seen this come to fruition in many different ways through the COVID crisis, for example. But you also see this in terms of patterns of behavior that have been established in society as a result of Zoom. So now you can do church, not as an embodied experience, but you can do church on Zoom. So virtual reality has huge ramifications, particularly if people buy into the virtual experience as opposed to the embodied experience.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the second crisis that I address in the book is the crisis of the body. And this, I think, is something we all are feeling keenly, whether we know it or not. We have this sort of easy breezy materialist mindset, this set of assumptions that just operates in the background of the world, that, you know, that everything's just made out of stuff, out of meat, that human beings, you can hear this online, they're just meat sacks with chemistry sets inside. And basically what we're doing is just manipulating our sort of physical surroundings so that our minds can feel as good as possible. And you can read people like Yuval Noah Harari, who writes in his book, Homo Deus, about the mystery of consciousness. Why is it that if everything is just atoms bouncing around, everything is just matter, why is it that we have this stream of sensations, desires, loves, dreams, emotions, aspirations? At some point, he says, if everything that happens to us is mechanical, when we say run away from a mountain lion, if that's just a chemical reaction triggering other physical movements, then why do we need to feel fear? and yet, of course, the reason the materialist worldview just doesn't work for us is because we do feel fear. It's almost the most immediate experience we have is that we have emotions in this life of ours, right? We actually have what's called qualitative experiences. And try though they may, they can't map that anywhere on a brain scan. They can show you the little lights that go off in your head when you fall in love, let's say, but they can't relate that in any meaningful way to the actual experience of being alive, of falling in love. And so, as I argue in the book, this is the reality of the soul. And maybe when you say that word, you think about like a little floaty ghost in a machine, or you think about some old-fashioned idea. But in fact, in Athens and Jerusalem alike, the idea that there is a consciousness, what we would now call a consciousness, that endures throughout our life, that exerts moral judgments, that teaches us about right and wrong, and that perceives things like colors, even as simple as that, but also love and desire, right? That's just kind of a basic brute fact about us. There's no getting around it. And so the question then becomes the exact opposite of Yuval Noah Harari's. He says, well, if we're just bodies, why the heck do we need to have consciousness? And the real thing that people fear and feel and worry about is, well, since I have this whole world, this whole inner life of dreams and desires and reason, why the hell do I need to have a body, this kind of appendage that we seem to be so uncomfortable with and have been since time immemorial? It breaks down, it gets sick, it eventually dies. Why can't I just float up into the pure realm of abstract ideas? And this was a temptation in classical Athens, just as much as it is now with all of our admiration of math and digital space and Zoom. Why can't I just disembody myself? And what this leads to, rather than the kind of pure ascent into the realm of the computer or of ideas, is actually this terrible discomfort with what we really are, which is embodied souls. And where you see this most right now and most clearly and most painfully is in the terrible craze for transgender interventions. People, you know, signing up these young kids, rushing them through these irrevocable processes that are supposed to make your body conform to some abstract notion you have about a floating disembodied self, right? And so we're going to perform these surgeries, we're going to perform hormone interventions, we're going to do all of these things that end up many young people in terrible regret, discomfort, pain, at lifelong war with their physical selves. And what I say in the book is this is not limited just to that trans phenomenon. This is a deeper thing that we're coming up against, this revulsion that we have at our bodies. And you see it also during COVID when people say, oh, you just, you know, meet on Zoom. It'll be, go to church over Zoom. It'll be better because you won't get all those nasty diseases. You won't have all those terrible threats and problems. Of course, what we realize and what we realized all throughout COVID is that there's something deeply wrong with that idea about ourselves. It's actually a false vision of humanity. The true vision of humanity is the one that we get perfectly encapsulated in the book of Genesis. When God takes dirt out of the ground, which is just matter, stuff, right? This is the stuff of the body. He breathes into it the breath of life. And then it becomes what in Hebrew is called a nefesh chayim, a living soul. You think of the Christian idea, the Jewish idea of the soul as this kind of disembodied floating breath, but you read the text closely, that's actually not true at all. Adam, the first human being, is a fusion of pure spirit and stuff and matter. That's what we are. That's what we're always going to be. It's what we're made to be. And we are God's physical representation in the physical world, made of matter, but not fully consisting only in matter. We are not matter. We are more than that. We're embodied souls. And you can't lose either part of that equation if you want to stay human and if you want to know true joy.
I want to press that just a little bit. When the Eastern fathers were grappling with the question of what sex we were going to be in the resurrection, they determined that the non-corporeal aspect of our humanity does not have a sex. Mm. Sex comes from the body. The soul is sexless, and therefore our sex or our internal sense of gender identity comes from the body. So there can, in that paradigm, never be such a thing as a man trapped in a woman's body.
Hmm. That's a very rich concept. And I've read a few passages, to me, moderately amusing passages from the church fathers. So not the Eastern tradition that you're reflecting on, but passages from the church fathers in which it's decided that we will all be male at the resurrection. But it's a similar notion, I think, actually, that our physical bodies are what kind of give us. There is no abstracted, pure notion of what you would now call gender, this term that kind of came into vogue with the sexologist, some might say child molester, John Money. And you know, this notion of gender is a purely fabricated concept. I think there are, whether you agree with the Eastern Church Fathers that that's because the soul is actually genderless or sexless, or whether you agree with something like a kind of Thomistic reading of Aristotle, that the soul and the body are simply not the kinds of things that would be in total diametric opposition, right? You can have distinction between the soul and the body. You can see that they are one and the other. But simply what it means for us to have a soul is that we are the first actuality of a natural body having life potentially. And so, yeah, this idea that you could be a man trapped in a woman's body, woman trapped in a man's body, depends on the notion that what you are, as Descartes kind of hints at in his discourse on method and on man, that what you are is a thinking thing. And so everything important, true about you is located in that kind of ethereal space. And what I would argue is there's really no way to square that with our experience or with any good Christian doctrine, that in fact, what we are is spirit woven into matter. We are enmeshed, immersed in matter, and will be so even at the resurrection. That's the whole point of affirming a doctrine of the resurrection, is that the body, even if it will be radically different than we can fathom or understand in our present state, it's not going away. It's not going to be something that we float up out of. The New Jerusalem comes down from heaven into earth. And I think there's tremendous wisdom in that, which, you know, we could do with recovering.
There's two things that you really light on in that chapter. One, you've already mentioned transgenderism, but you also talk about how transgenderism, in some sense, morphs into transhumanism. It's like there's a slippery slope, and on that slope, you go from transgenderism into the horror of transhumanism.
Well, this was made very explicit by a male to female transgender person. So a man who undertook to transition to a woman named Martine Rothblatt. And Rothblatt's book is called From Transgender to Transhuman. And I believe the subtitle is something like a manifesto. And so in the more kind of obscure online circles where this stuff is discussed, you can find it made very plain, but you don't have to go like digging into these little corners of the internet to find it. All you have to do is open up TikTok and find out what the latest pronoun is, because we see this all the time and we make fun of it or we laugh about it, but I don't think that we really reckon with it and understand it. You see people saying, well, my pronouns are pup self, meaning I'm a puppy, or my pronouns are demon self, meaning I am a demon. You have robot pronouns, you have fish pronouns, all sorts of, you know, variations upon gender identity that actually take you out of the human sphere altogether. And when you stop and think about it, you realize that this is actually the cutting edge of this body crisis. Even as riveting and difficult and painful to deal with as transgenderism itself is, it is only the first manifestation of a much deeper philosophical error, which is the total division of cleavage of body and soul. And once you have established that cleavage in your mind, which was accomplished by people like Judith Butler, you know, the sort of initiator of a lot of gender theory, once you've really split humanity down the middle between their body, which is this hunk of flesh like any other, and their soul, which is some abstract truth, well, then actually, not only the world around you, but your own person, your own self, becomes just more putty, more clay to rearrange as you wish. And so you do see people, sad to say, people in, you know, deep into this kind of confusion, you know, identifying as disabled and so amputating body parts. You see people grafting horns onto themselves and all sorts of other sort of animalistic ideas. And the reason for this is that what it really is about is the body crisis and post-humanism or transhumanism, which is a very explicit philosophy among some of these communities, is just the kind of logical, horrific next step. Just as the reality crisis blows the doors open on true and false, the body crisis blows the doors open on human identity and human personhood. Eventually, you end up with no North Star, no guiding light, no ground to stand on at all. Just whatever thought happens to occur to you in this moment is the thing that you feel you need to embody or seek out. And that is a route that is already causing all sorts of devastation and pain. So I'd say there's no reason why we need to go any further down that route as is now being offered to us.
Yeah, there's so much treasure that we could unpack in that particular chapter as well. Transgenderism, transhumanism, but you have to get the book to figure that out because we simply don't have time on the podcast. It's really worth reading. How to Save the West, Ancient Wisdom from Five Modern Crises. I want to get to the third of the crises that you deal with in the book, the crises of meaning. What is that?
Well, this is something that touches on a lot of our debates that you might put under the heading of the culture war, right? And we hear that term thrown around a lot, I think. And as people who are conservative, who tend to lean right, I think we typically feel like we're losing the culture war, right? That's the general feeling that I sense, the attitude, especially after 2020 with that kind of neo-Marxist cultural revolution we all went through, that now with, you know, cancel culture, and especially with art, the movies, and the music that we see kind of coming out of our major cultural centers, we start to feel as if there's been this total breakdown in what art is considered beautiful, what art is considered valuable, moral, what have you. And for a long time, that fight was proposed. It was sort of described in this way. You've got conservatives who feel like they just want to establish their morality in art. They want to fight for a more moral artistic world. And then you've got liberals who are, like the name says, they're liberals, right? They don't want any moral rules about what you can and can't show in art. Vladimir Nabokov, who wrote Lolita, famous novel about a child molester, he said that he was just writing art for aesthetic bliss, right? Just kind of pure, whatever delights him, that's what he's making. There's no morals, there's no, you know, ethics involved in art. And it may be that for a while, that was the fight we were in. But if you take a fresh look at the culture wars, what you'll realize is that's actually not an accurate description of what's going on right now. It's not moralist conservatives and libertine leftists. Because when you listen to leftists talk about art and culture, they have very strict moral rules as well, right? You need to make sure that you have a certain racial makeup, a certain number of minorities in leading roles, right? You must absolutely ensure that no negative messages are conveyed about those people who are minorities in those roles. There probably ought to be some non-traditional sexual arrangements involved. These are moral codes. They're not moral in the sense of being morally good, but they are ideas about morality that are very strongly enforced, both in terms of what gets made and in terms of what gets praised, right? You have to make stuff this way, is what the left is saying. You have to show the world this way. And so that's why what we're really up against is a crisis of meaning, because what we're actually dealing with are two incompatible moral visions of the world that the left is trying to enforce one through art, and we on the right, or we conservatives, are attempting to enforce what we believe is a truer, or to enact a truer idea about morals in art. And that finally leads us to this real question, which is, what's art supposed to do anyway? Why do we go to the movies? Why do we listen to music? Why do we do all this stuff? The reason is because it reflects life back to us. This is the concept known in Greek philosophy as mimesis, imitation, replication. And when you dig into this concept, you find that it actually goes way, way deep, way down to really the bottom of everything we do. Mimesis, imitation. Aristotle says mankind is the most imitative of animals. He imitates from childhood. And you see this in preschools. You go into kindergarten, people are learning by repeating songs back at their teacher. And Wordsworth, the poet, has this beautiful line about an infant babe looking up into his mother's eyes and receiving humanity from his mother's face because she smiles at him until he smiles back, right? This is a core part of who we are and what we are. And it's why we do art even in the first place. And so, of course, as I sort of hint throughout the book, but really kind of get into here, really the question of meaning is the question of what are we imitating? And so it becomes the question of God. If humankind is an image-making animal, if we are in some sense even images, what are we images of? And that's why we're fighting over art so passionately. It's not because this or that movie is good or bad. It's because we are in a deep, deep struggle over the question of meaning, of what humanity is, and therefore what kind of art we should make about life.
It's so interesting if you look at academia today. Academia says there is no meaning in many contexts. For example, I've often quoted the vaunted professor of philosophy at Duke, His name is Dr. Alex Rosenberg. And let me paraphrase a little bit of what he says. He says, what is the meaning or the purpose of the universe? And he answers his question rhetorically by saying, there is none. Mm-hmm. Is there such thing as morality? No. He says, anything goes. There's no intrinsic moral value. Everything is nihilism. Is there purpose to life? No, there is none. Is there meaning to life? Of course not. Is there a soul? Are you kidding? Is there free will? Not a chance. What's the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? Anything goes. Does history have meaning or purpose? Talk about the crisis of meaning. No, history is full of sound and fury. It ultimately signifies nothing. That's kind of the water we swim in today. It's the air that we breathe. And I think it really personifies the horror of life without meaning. And it is a microcosm of the crisis of meaning.
That's beautifully put. In the book, the figure that I deal with in this respect is Richard Dawkins, big, you know, very famous kind of scientist, philosopher of science. His book, The Selfish Gene, made a really big splash when it came out, and indeed kind of reinvigorated this notion of mimesis, imitation, by taking the concepts of evolution and applying them to culture in what Dawkins called the meme. This is where we get our word meme, you know, that we now spread online. When you spread a meme online, right, it comes from that Greek word mimesis, means thing that you can replicate over and over again. And if it's successful, it survives, right? And Dawkins basically reanimates this ancient idea, which you can find in Plato, that the whole universe is kind of one big replication machine, but with this one crucial difference. That's just as your, you know, Duke philosopher says, that what's the point? What's the meaning of it all? Nothing, right? It just happens. It just is. And the reason that it's important to understand that that is the express philosophy that operates in kind of pop culture is because it goes right to the heart of not science itself, but what science has become, what it has been used to mean in public life. When Dr. Fauci said, you know, I am the science, I represent the science, I think he said at some point during COVID. When he said that, everybody that knows anything about science said, well, no person is the science, right? Science is a process of inquiry. Things can be proven wrong, right? You can argue. But what he meant by that is that I am the keeper of the equations to hack the universe. I am the one who knows the rules of good and bad, and therefore there is no debate. The science is settled, right? Climate change is coming. You all need to stick in your homes. You need to stop having children. You need to eat the bugs. You need to live in the pod. And the reason that Fauci thinks he can say that with such certainty is because he is operating according to this idea of the mechanistic universe. And I deal with this in some detail in the book, that, you know, the notion that everything is just matter, it's just physical, it's just stuff, that notion comes along with a conviction that everything behaves according to predictable rules. And what these guys never answer, Stephen Hawking made exactly the same argument in the Wall Street Journal, and these guys never answer the question, where do the rules come from, right? Rules are not physical. Rules are not stuff. They are operations of the mind, right? But that is kind of left off the table or just ignored, shrugged away. And what you end up with is just a machine, right? Just this thing that spits out certain consequences and results. And usually this is presented in this kind of faux inspirational way. You get Carl Sagan, right? We are star stuff, right? Meaning we're just made of the atoms that stars cough up, right? And Sarah Silverman, the comedian, says something similar when she won, I think, her Emmy. She said, like, you know, we're just atoms and we're hurtling through the universe. And isn't that great? Doesn't that set us free? Isn't that liberating? You go online, you read what regular people say, you get a very different story. I've seen Reddit posts where people say things like, I'm just atoms. Why does anything matter? Right? That's the crisis of meaning. Because of course, if it is just there, if it's just doing mindlessly what the universe has always done from infinity and will go on doing into infinity, then actually there's no reason to live at all. There's no meaning to anything that you do, because there's no ultimate object of your mimesis, of your representation. And I think we are really up against that crisis, not just in its kind of failure to explain the universe and the necessity of inventing all these things like, you know, multiple universes to account for the otherwise obvious hints of design that we see, but also in its failure to inspire. Our attempts, our art gets worse and worse the more we dig into this. And the example I give in the book is the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the MCU, which has now become a multiverse because that's the latest, right, in kind of purely mechanistic, godless physics. And those stories, why do they get worse and worse? Why are they such schlock? Well, it's because when somebody dies, right, it doesn't actually have any consequence. It's just a bunch of atoms kind of dissipating. Maybe they'll come back together in another universe or at another time. The only thing that really is driving those plots at this point is the financial convenience of the studios and the actors and the executives. And the more this stuff breaks down and the more they, you know, dig in their heels about, oh, the science is settled and trust the experts, right? Trust the science. The more you see that really you're up against two competing religions, the religion of meaning and the religion of what I call scientism. That's the crisis. That's the choice that we face.
Yeah, so well said. We've touched on the crisis of reality, the crisis of the body, the crisis of meaning. I want to get into the fourth crisis, the crisis of religion. What is that crisis to your understanding?
Yeah. Well, it follows directly on from what we've been discussing with regards to science. There was a moment in the history of the West, which is typically kind of referred to as the scientific revolution. And no moment, I think, is more misunderstood in our relatively recent history than this moment, this sort of 300 to 400 year period, where not only did Protestantism become a major force, and not only did the, you know, Catholic Church lose some of its grip over the political world in Europe during the 30 Years' War and so forth, but also, of course, this is what came to be known as sort of this new enlightenment, this new idea about the world that it could be known through reason as a kind of machine comes into being. And in order to do that, which has, you know, in some ways, there were many things that came out of science, the scientific revolution, that were very wonderful. All sorts of medicines, technologies, right? We live longer. Nobody would want to undo any of that. The process, though, of achieving this sort of revolution was to treat the world as if without reference to God. And as I say in the book, that's very, very different from saying that God does not exist. And in fact, when Isaac Newton was challenged, asked, you know, what is it that exerts this force of gravity that acts at a distance? He said, hypotheses non fingo. I'm not going to make up hypotheses where my science isn't trying to answer those questions. And in some sense, as the philosophy of science has developed in the 20th century and with people like Karl Popper, you've had this narrowing, this real precision about what does science do? Well, it finds the questions that you can pose and answer in these experimental ways. And that is a noble and longstanding practice with roots way back into the natural philosophy of Aristotle and indeed even before. What simultaneously happened is that sophists, pop philosophers, represented this triumph as a triumph over God, as if by excluding God from the question, what we had done was disprove his existence. Because if we can account for everything that matters, well, then we don't need God to explain anything. And you see, it's very so subtle what happens there, because of course, you can account for everything that matters if you define everything that matters as physical. You can answer every question if you never ask any of the questions to which God is the only possible answer. You never say, well, you know, what is the purpose of human life? What is the meaning in the universe? Why do I feel things? Why do I have qualitative experiences and a soul rather than just a body, right? And so now you end up in this position where, sort of absurdly, people think that religion has been disproven or outdated. And yet, at the same time, all around us, the very stones cry out of our need for religion. Because what we've really done, rather than giving up or abandoning our religion, people say the West is secularizing. It's not quite true. What's actually happened is that these practices like science and these social justice movements have begun to take on the character of a religion. We turn to them for the meaning of our lives, for questions about right and wrong. We kneel at Black Lives Matter rallies. We sort of perform these ritual acts of absolution and forgiveness. Because mankind is more than physical, human beings need answers to questions that physical science can't answer. And so when you cut that route off, when you cut the vertical element out of human life, then you force people into this absurd position of using whatever they can get their hands on as if it were a religion. And this is why you get these kind of awestruck descriptions of evolution, primordial slime gradually developing into the human mind. And isn't it beautiful that this mindless universe coughed up a human being? These stories that we tell that don't fit with what's actually being said at all, that are pure wishmaking, because what we are so desperate for is a philosophy, is a way of understanding the world that doesn't just reduce us to mindless atoms bouncing through a void. And of course, what I argue in the book is, you know, sometimes Christians, we try to proselytize right into like every possible doctrine all at once. You get the Nicene Creed, you know, in all of its points immediately. But the advice that I have for evangelists in this book, if any, is that, you know, the people you're dealing with, the people in the Western world right now, are crying out, struggling with much more basic questions. They're in need of much more basic food. We have to take our baby steps again and recognize that none of these crises, the crisis of the body, the crisis of reality, the crisis of meaning, none of these crises is going to be meaningful or satisfactorily answered until we admit that there is something beyond the material world, something more than flesh, something that is spiritual. And that's the crisis of religion, and there's only one way out.
You've already touched on this, but I want you to expand at least briefly on your contention that the Enlightenment did a disservice to Western civilization, a disservice because the scientism becomes popular, the religion is denigrated as barbarous, and it is repositioned as a hazard as opposed to the solution.
Well, one thing I think, and I say this in the book, one thing that we typically don't understand about the period that's called the Enlightenment, right, this sort of, you know, 18th century flowering of the humanistic arts, is that it's really coming in the wake of all those developments I just described earlier, which are to say that the Protestant Reformation, the Thirty Years' War, which undermined, called into question the authority of the Catholic Church for good or ill. I'm making absolutely no claim here about the positive or negative value of, you know, the Catholic authority that was exerted in Europe before this moment. But just as a matter of fact, when you, as Europe did, when you say that each nation, each prince is now going to be free essentially to govern according to his own sect or kind of Christianity, you suddenly throw open this question about where authority rests. Where do we look for truth? And I think there was a lot that was salutary about asking that question. We should be bold to ask any question, seek any truth that needs finding. But what you get then in sort of in the wake of that is this caricature of religion as the purely oppressive force that held back all of this creative energy that we're now releasing in the glorious scientific revolution, but also in the glorious French Revolution. And, you know, even as these revolutions devolve often into bloodshed or anarchy or uncertainty, chaos, you still have this conviction, which, you know, again, I would never attribute to every Enlightenment philosophe. I would never say that, you know, everybody was involved in this grand conspiracy at this moment. But what you did have were people like Julien Offray de Lamettrie, you had Diderot, you had indeed Voltaire famously saying, écrasez l'infâme, get rid of the disgusting infamy, which is the church, right? And not even necessarily at that point was it yet get rid of God, although it was in some cases, but it was just get rid of these hierarchies, these institutions. And you see in that moment the beginning of a gesture that we now make all the time, which is, you know, this institution, this part of our culture, Western civilization more generally, as we began by talking about, is run by flawed individuals. Christopher Columbus did bad things. Some of the founding fathers kept slaves, right? And so they fell short, indeed, of all these grand ideals. And therefore, we must condemn them because we know so much more than they do. What that always misses out, what you always lose when you act and think that way, is you miss the fact that the reason the founding fathers fall short in your estimation is because of values that the founding fathers instilled in you through the documents that they left behind. It's true everywhere, at all times and places, that human beings fall short of their ideals. But the only way that we even know that they fall short is because of those ideals in the first place. And so when you say, for instance, of the church, well, this was, you know, the church was not as open to, say, the heliocentric universe, to the idea that the earth revolves around the sun. The church wasn't as open to that as it ought to have been. You think, well, where do you get the idea of openness in the first place, right? Where do you have this notion that truth, right, needs seeking? Well, of course, this comes in large part out of the church itself. It's because of the long centuries of the academic tradition that the scientific revolution in some ways reacts against, right? It's because of this huge structure of Western thought that we even, you know, began to do what became the scientific revolution in the first place. And so we have this constant, I call it chronological chauvinism in the book, this constant knee-jerk reaction now that if the development of something doesn't live up to our standards, then what we ought to do is get rid of it altogether. And what we realize then all too late is that the standards came from the thing we just throw out to begin with. And so it's the very definition of throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Talk about the scientific infatuation with multiverse. That's something you touch on in the book, and I think it's worth elaborating. I run into it all the time. Mm. It seems to be the explanation. You can infinitely regress with this explanation. You never come to a solution, but there's a fascination with this hypothesis.
It's such a fad. It's very, very popular, and popular even among people who, if you show them its consequences, will suddenly think, oh, maybe I don't really want to believe in that as much as I thought. In essence, as I argue in the book, when you come up against multiverse theories and the popularity of multiverse theories, what you're dealing with is the gradual accumulation of, I won't say evidence because it's not, you know, you never get a final proof of these matters, but more and more indications, hints, that the creative impulse of a mind is the best explanation for many of the phenomena we see in our universe, in the universe we occupy. Fine-tuning is a good example of this phenomenon, which sort of throughout the late 20th century, these kind of observations that all sorts of mathematical constants operate in the physical universe just within the narrow band of values that they need to have in order for conscious life to come into being. The configuration of mass and energy at the beginning of the universe was just so balanced that human life could eventually exist within this universe. And this concept, which indicates at least that one good explanation would be, as the astrophysicist Fred Hoyle put it, a super intellect that monkeys with the universe. The sort of shadow of God is looming in these data, unless you're devoted to preserving the materialist universe, which again is not a finding of science. No experiment ever proved that the world is made up only of matter and there's nothing supernatural in it. It's a premise, a presupposition of many scientific endeavors. And so in order to preserve that premise, you have to think of some other explanation for all these phenomena that we see in the world. And the multiverse is one way of doing that, of accounting for our universe and the way it looks without invoking God. If our universe is just one among a potentially infinite number of universes, well, then it's just like the monkeys at the typewriter, right? They're clacking away and eventually they cough up the text of Hamlet because given enough time and enough variations, you're bound to produce what you might call a bubble universe where life exists. And so there's kind of two versions of this in point of fact. One of them is a proposition that was sort of floated by Erwin Schrödinger of the famous Schrödinger's cat thought experiment, and then really fleshed out by this guy, Hugh Everett, the notion that because quantum physics operates with equations that have kind of indeterminacy built into them, multiple possibilities before an observer is introduced into the picture, well, then maybe we can imagine that all of those possibilities are always obtaining, right? They're always happening in some universe or another. So Schrödinger's cat isn't dead and alive before we observe it. It's not dead or alive. It's dead in our universe and alive in some other universe, or it's alive in this universe and it's dead in another. The other version of this is string cosmology has this kind of notion of an expanding universe that's constructed out of minutely vibrating strings that then break down and sort of reconstitute themselves in different pockets. You'll notice that nothing I've said has quite fixed the problem, because if you just propose that there's this big universe generating machine, well, who built the machine, right? Like you're just sort of kicking the can down the road. But even leaving that problem aside, there's all sorts of issues with both of these ideas. The bubble universe theory is founded on all sorts of things that we have never observed and can never observe. And some advocates of it are even proposing that we should give the scientific imprimatur even to things that aren't provable by experiment, just to preserve this notion of the multiverse. But a bigger problem from the perspective of somebody like me is, well, once you're operating in terms of hypotheses, just imaginary sort of speculative ideas about what we would call cosmology, then you don't actually get to argue as if you have some scientific finding. What you're really doing is you're doing religion. You're doing theology, you're doing cosmology.
Under the guise of science. Yeah.
Exactly, with the imprimatur, as if nobody can argue with you. But in fact, we very much can argue over these sorts of things and have been doing since the beginning, when Epicurus proposed that there were multiple universes, and all the same problems still maintain, right? Like, what does it even mean to have an identity or to make an observation in a multiverse when everything is happening somewhere at some point, right? That movie is called Everything Everywhere All at Once. If you watch that movie, it's about the fact that that whole notion is just nihilism. It just explodes the possibility of any action, any love, any connection. All these things break down because the whole idea is kind of a canard.
I want you to elaborate on a statement that you make in the book before we get into the fifth crisis. You say, and I'm quoting you directly here, you say, "I'm suggesting that you already act as if you believe in the world described by Scripture and not the world described by the multiverse and the Marvel Cinematic Universe. In your heart of hearts, you don't believe in meaninglessness. You don't really accept the idea that the physical facts fix all the facts. People intuitively know that there's more than physical facts." And you say, we should just remind people of what they already perceive and believe. I think that's a brilliant insight. You're simply reminding people of what they have already intuited.
That's right. That's right. I think at some point I say it's less a conversion than a surrender. It's allowing yourself to believe things that you operate as if you believe in every day, but you've been kind of talked out of by the fashions of the day. People who read footnotes, if you like reading footnotes and you search through the footnotes of my book, you will find a little story about one of the disciples of a Greek philosopher named Heraclitus. Now, Heraclitus was the real deal relativist. He went whole hog. He believed that all was in flux, and indeed that every perception is a perception of something different at each moment. And one of his disciples ended up, we're told, saying nothing at all, because every statement would be false the moment it was uttered, and because everything was constantly in this flow of atoms. And so all he did was move his finger. He just sat and moved his finger around. That is a relativist with the courage of his convictions. That is somebody who is living his life, sitting alone and moving his finger because nothing else matters or makes any sense. That is a relativist who is actually living his life according to the implications of his belief. Other people who live their lives as if God does not exist include the Marquis de Sade, right? I mean, these are people who actually operate as if there is no morality, there's no absolute truth. You who are listening to us have this conversation, you out there in the world, don't live that way and really can't. Because in fact, as you say, in your heart of hearts, you know it's not right. You know it's not true that good and bad is just what, you know, we make of it, that there is no right or wrong, but thinking makes it so, that the universe is meaningless. You get out of bed in the morning, and by that very act, you prove that something else is there. There is some good, right? Every action that we do implies some good that we're aiming at. And so, you know, if you're teetering on the brink of this stuff, of this nihilism, of this despair, if that's how you're operating in your life, what you really just have to do is come back to yourself and just notice that, like, every day, every morning, you open your eyes and you stand up and you do something, make yourself a cup of coffee. Why do you do that? Well, because you want coffee. Why do you want coffee? Well, because coffee is good, right? You think it's good for you, or you think it's going to do something good. And right in that moment, the minute you say that, you have to realize that you have something in your mind called the good that you measure your actions by, that you use to guide your life. And that North Star, which is present in the simplest acts that you do every morning, that North Star is the one that's going to guide you home to what you really believe.
I want you to expand on one of the other statements you make in the book. You say, "I'm not trying to refute or disprove any claim that science makes. I am trying to invest science once again with the glory it has stolen from itself by answering questions it was never designed to ask."
C.S. Lewis, in his Space trilogy, which, if people haven't read that, it's, I think, his best fiction, right at the beginning of the space trilogy, Lewis talks about the mythology which follows on in the wake of science. That's what I'm talking about in that passage as well. I'm not talking for a second about, you know, you need to live in a mud hut and you need to tear down the telephone wires outside your house. So you need to, because where would that end, right? I mean, we've been making tools since we have existed as a species. That's not what I'm trying to rob you of or anybody of. I don't want anybody to give up on the search for truth, even scientific truth. What I do want to do is take the burden off of science that science has placed upon itself and cannot sustain. I mean, I represent the science, trust the science, light a prayer candle to Dr. Fauci. That's a real thing, by the way. I mean, you know, these are acts of worship that just won't work when you bring them to science that exists purely for dealing with physical material objects. I mean, what does the Bible say about idols, right? They have eyes but do not see. They have mouths but do not speak. They're carved. Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah, says that he cuts down a tree. He uses one half of it for firewood, and then he carves the other half into a statue and he bows down before it. The things of this world, the physical stuff that the world is made out of, is good, is created by God, but cannot sustain our worship. That's the central insight of the Hebrew Bible and of Jerusalem, right? And we laugh at those, you know, dumb old idol worshipers who bow down before wooden carvings. But here we are, right, talking to our AI as if it were alive, right? Writing programs and saying, you know, what should we do about climate change? Feeding it into our models and acting according to those predictions, right? All of this is a kind of idol worship, and all idol worship just turns the worshiper into the deaf, blind, and dumb, mute statue that he's worshiping. And that's kind of the position we're now in. Science can't sustain the worship that we're putting on it because it was never designed to. It was never meant to. It has its own place, its own thing to do. And it's not to satisfy our craving for worship, because there's only one thing that can do that.
I don't think it's trite to say last but not least in terms of the crises that you enumerated in your book. The last crisis is the regime crisis. What do you mean by the crisis of regime?
Well, the word regime is another one that, you know, people use it all the time for all sorts of different meanings. When I use the word regime, I'm talking about something very close to the ancient Greek notion of politics. And when we say politics, what we mean is like tax hikes or, you know, municipal paving or whatever sort of uninteresting issue that we don't want to have to deal with at the city council meeting. And so when we say don't get political, what we mean is don't drag into this kind of pleasant conversation these issues of voting or these fights that we might have over Republican and Democrat. And I think that the reason why so many of our political fights have reached a stalemate is because they are political in exactly that narrow sense. They are based on this kind of, what are we going to do about this particular problem right now? Well, we have totally opposing first principles about it, so we just have to get in a big fight. Politics in the Greek origin is the word politike, techne politike. And politike is, again, a word that comes from polis, which just means a city-state or a community. You might call it a koinonia, a life together, a shared life. And what Aristotle famously says about that kind of politics is that man is by nature a political animal. And what that means is that we do not get born into this world, you know, drawing charts about tax policy. What that means is that wherever there are human beings, there are customs, rituals, and rules of life together. That's politics in the deep sense, and your regime, your kind of operative leadership class, those are the people who are in charge of that, who kind of operate according to those rules, but also set those rules, help to enforce them. And your small c constitution is the whole shape of that life together. So not just our big C constitution, which is the law of the land, but what Aristotle refers to as, you know, marrying and intermarrying, doing festivals together, going to baseball games. He wouldn't have put it that way, but if Aristotle were alive today, I'm sure he would be a Yankees fan. And, you know, this whole concept, you know, what are we even doing here? Why are we, you know, living together? Why do we have neighbors? Why would we go to a town council meeting or to a PTA meeting? And when you get up against that, then you can really start to talk about, well, what's the shape of our regime? And so I go into the book, this, you know, ancient idea of the cycle of regimes, the different kinds of living together that people do and the way that they kind of fall from grace over time. The American regime, as founded, is what's called a republic, which is designed to be a perpetual motion machine, which is to say it takes the different kinds of regime, the different kinds of government, and balances them against one another so that each form of decay is kind of met with another sort of remedy from elsewhere. So I go into some of the writing of the founding fathers and how that genius act that they performed in the 1770s of building the foundations of our country was based on their profound erudition and close reading of the ancient sources that developed this whole idea. Why is this important for today? We know we're facing a crisis in America, but I'm not sure that everybody knows quite what kind of a crisis we're up against. And really what we're up against is a crisis of what's called civic love. Philia, politike philia, political friendship or love is the missing ingredient in really all of our political debates. And it's not like some nice touchy-feely, lovey-dovey, sing kumbaya. It's the actual work every day of waking up in the morning and operating with the guy next to you, not on Twitter, not out in Washington, whatever, but with the guy next to you as if you have a shared and common goal. And so that's what I end up arguing for in the book as something that people can actually do without relying on the next big election or the next big crisis. And something that we can actually do when we wake up tomorrow to help take this country forward.
Just a little more elaboration on the cycle of regimes. You started on that, but I think it's such an important concept for people to grasp. Monarchy becoming tyranny, aristocracy becoming oligarchy, and democracy becoming mob rule. And maybe in concert with that, the maxim that hard times create strong men create good times create weak men, and then weak men create the hard times again.
Yep. I really love that quote because it's just perfectly kind of a modern vernacular encapsulation of this ancient concept, which in Greek you would call anacyclosis, which is a kind of fancy word just meaning the cycle and recycling of regimes. In ancient political philosophy, going back, you know, to in some sense to Plato, also there's in the great historian Herodotus, there's sort of a discussion of these sorts of things, but then really formalized in Aristotle. You have these three types, three ways of doing life together that are kind of basic, right? And they are, as you mentioned, they are monarchy, aristocracy, and the name differs throughout history, but you know, we would call it democracy, rule by the many. And so you have rule by one man, rule by a few, and rule by the many. And because humanity is broken, each of these kinds of rules is capable of decay. And the crucial feature of that decay is good governments are ruled by people who have the good of the ruled in mind. So a good king rules for the good of his subjects. A good aristocracy rules for the good of the rest of the people. And indeed, even a good majority, a good democratic polity, will make choices based on the good of that group and not trample on what we would now call minority rights, right? In America, because we have this notion of our democracy and because we are indeed founded as a republic, we're typically inclined to say, oh, monarchy bad, right? We rebelled against a king. George III is gone now. So we have to, and we certainly don't want to be ruled by Harry and Meghan. So we think, you know, this is like a kind of a bad thing altogether. But the ancient truth is actually that, you know, in different contexts, different places, different times, each of these forms of government can be done well, but if it can be done well, it can also be done badly. And human beings being what they are, they're going to eventually start to decay. And so Aristotle, and then later after him, Polybius, who was a historian of the rise of the Roman Empire, Polybius writes that there is this kind of natural cycle that occurs as the different regimes decay and replace one another. And so you begin with monarchy and maybe you have a good king, but inevitably you're going to get, you know, a degenerate son, let's say, a son that's spoiled, just raised from his youth as a kind of ne'er-do-well. And eventually what you'll end up with is a tyrant, somebody who just wants to rule for his own good, his own sake. Tyranny begets resentment, of course, as we have seen many a time in even America's history. People want to rise up against oppressive rule. And so you get what you think of as kind of an aristocratic revolution, the noblemen. Think of like King John and his barons and the writing of Magna Carta in English history. The noblemen rise up and assert their right not to be unduly taxed, what have you. But of course, if they take over, well, then you've got just a bunch of cronies eventually, right? People who start to do backroom deals for themselves and for their own benefit. And the people begin to resent that. And so you have a natural spirited reaction, which is a popular revolution, gets you to a kind of democratic state. But democracy of all things, pure democracy, is the most fragile and degenerates into what's called autocracy, the rule of the mob rule. Abraham Lincoln warned of this in his Lyceum Address. The whole point of this, of course, once you end up in mob rule, then you can get a strong man who comes in and exerts control, as we saw in Chaz Chop not too long ago, the autonomous zone. And then you end up just starting the cycle again. So the question is, how do we get out of the cycle? How do we break the cycle? The answer, the classical answer is, well, we build a structure that plays these different forms of power, different forms of rule against one another. You'll have a leader, you'll have a leadership class, the aristocracy, call it the Senate, for instance, and then you'll have the people who have some input either through judges or through voting, right? I mean, in our case, of course, we have the vote, right? The thing that this kind of system is most vulnerable to, and Machiavelli, the great, you know, the writer of Realpolitik, Machiavelli is really great about this. And he observes how Rome fell after, you know, Polybius wrote about the greatness of this republic. And as the empire started to come really into focus, he says, what happened? Well, you really had class dissension. You had fights between the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots. And once you understand that's the Achilles heel of the republic, right? When we split apart according to our groups, according to our tribes, so that we're not operating on one machine, but we're, as Plato says, we're two cities in one or two countries in one, then you are on the road to perdition. Once you understand that, then you understand why it's so poisonous to tell people that their identity is rooted in some other kind of demographic feature besides their common cause as Americans, that you are not actually, you know, first and foremost an American, you're first and foremost a person of color, you're first and foremost an LGBTQIA plus individual, you're first and foremost, you know, just any number of kind of demographic categories, an Asian American, let's say. And that creates, instead of a republic, a zero-sum game where people are just fighting over goodies and preferential treatment. This is why, you know, you might think that you'd be kind of like beating a political hobby horse or something here, but this is why conservatives are reacting so strongly against the tribalism of the left. It's not because, you know, oh, those, you know, we want to own the libs, or we want to, you know, fight back against all those nasty Marxists or whatever. It's because it's, this stuff is poison. It's poison to a republic. It corrodes the bonds that are supposed to hold us together. If we start to think of ourselves as organized into these interest groups, all against all, group against group, until there's nothing left.
A couple of last questions. I think they're axiomatic. We've talked about the dark side of technology. There's a bright side to technology as well.
That's right. I really want to stress this because I have a lot of criticisms about how technology is currently used in the book. But just like when the printing press came into being and it unleashed all sorts of chaos and there were all sorts of negative reactions, but ultimately what you had was this kind of explosive ability now to place information in people's hands. We've got a lot of people in this country and around the world generally who want to seize control of our digital communications technology. You want to say what you can and can't say online. I want to cancel people, want to hound them out of jobs. All of that stuff is very real, very dangerous. I don't want to minimize it. And I don't want to suggest that, like, you know, they're going away anytime soon. But I do want to say that by the nature of the technology itself, they are ultimately bound to fail. When people take this stuff into their own hands, when we use this tech to found businesses, to communicate with one another, to organize, right, to realize that we're actually not crazy for thinking that man should be judged by the content of his character, not the color of his skin, right, then we are doing what this technology enables us to do at the highest possible level. The use that we put this tech to ought to be guided by the ancient principles, not the other way around. We don't throw out our ancient principles because we develop new tech. We take whatever new tech that may come, and we understand it in light of the great wisdom of the past.
A few last words as you titled your last chapter. You talk about where our salvation lies, the salvation for the West, the salvation for our culture, the salvation for Western civilization. You point out that if America falls, it doesn't mean that Western civilization falls. I think in setting up the question, I've often said that the ballot box is necessary, it's not sufficient. And you make that same point in a different way. You kind of point to the power of localism, that the light that shines the farthest also shines brightest at home. And so you're arguing that the solution or the salvation for Western civilization or even for America lies in doing daily things that have built the West, starting families, going to church, working, saving, investing, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, comforting the afflicted, doing the very things that Jesus said, you know, if you've done this for the least of these, my brethren, you've done it unto me. So it's important, I think, to expand for just a moment on that concept which you so powerfully proclaim in the book, that we need to affect those things which we can affect rather than just criticizing things that we have no handle on and no real opportunity to change.
Thank you. Yeah, that's beautifully put. And here's what I would stress. You know, if America falls or undergoes radical transformation even more than it has, that will be a catastrophe. I don't want to laugh off or shrug off the urgency of the ballot box, of this country. We are the city on a hill still, you know, as we go, so goes freedom in the world, at least for the time being. But the thing to remember, beyond all of that, to stave off despair, and because it's true, is that when you understand yourself as a citizen of the West, and when you know that the reason America matters is because she is the great inheritor and the great carrier of these traditions forward into the future, then you also understand that the game you're playing, the project you're in, is longer than a human life and is orchestrated by more than a human hand. And as you start to examine the history of the West, you will realize that it is full of moments in which, just as everything seemed to be collapsing around the ears of those who wished the West well, at that very moment, the foundations were being laid for something new. The other concept, of course, that hovers like a dove over the water in the history of the West is the concept of resurrection. And like the one who was resurrected, that concept is threaded into the fabric of all creation and is known at every moment and never dies. This is the sort of thing that you see, for instance, when Cicero is up against the end of the Republic, as he begins to try to write down the theory and the philosophy that made the Republic great, not just powerful, but actually good. And as he ends up, you know, dying at the hands of the new regime, he couldn't have known, but we can see that the inheritance he left would be the seeds of our republic, that John Adams would pore over Cicero's speeches and try to understand what it was that made the republic great and could make ours great again. You look, for instance, at King Josiah, who in 2 Kings recovers the book of the Torah in the temple and has it read aloud, just as Israel is about to suffer its terrible catastrophe because of the sins of Manasseh, that it's going to go into Babylonian exile. But it was those Deuteronomistic texts, those laws, those rituals, those customs that they would take with them that would form the foundation of a new understanding of the Jewish faith that could endure even the fall of the promised land and would indeed endure on into the days of Jesus. And this whole story that is still going on, is still being written, does not stand or fall, does not hang or depend on whether you get your way in the next election, even if that's important. What it depends on is that every day people like you and me wake up and we decide that we are going to choose the good insofar as we possibly can and serve what is best in the world. And that's all we can do. It's enough. It's all we need to do. The rest is up to God.
I want to conclude the podcast by quoting you once again. You say to defend the West or to save the West, you have to be the West. And here's this concluding paragraph that I think is worth reading. You say we have to live it in our everyday lives. You're a thing fearfully and wonderfully made for the glory of God, and you can live like it. I cannot promise you that your life will be happy, but I can promise that wherever you are, however well or badly things are going right now, your life has meaning. I can promise that truth, beauty, and goodness are not figments of your imagination or accidents of your biology, that they exist and that you are a creature designed to seek them. And nothing is more real than that. I got to tell you, Spencer, you are right in concert with the mission statement of the Hank Unplugged podcast. You're interesting, you're informative, you're inspirational. I find it a marvel that you were able to communicate these five crises in a couple hundred pages in a way that the average person can understand. I mean, I think this is a book, and I've had the experience myself with this book, that reading it the second time is better than reading it the first time, because you fill in gaps that you didn't quite catch the first time. I think really, if you want to understand a book, you should read it three times. But I think this is a book that is well worth reading. I hope it is a great success. And I'd also say that I enjoyed our personal conversation and look forward to continuing that conversation over a beer, as you said, in our private conversation sometime in the future. But you are well respected and appreciated on the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Well, the feeling is entirely mutual. I'm so grateful to you. You know, it's it's one thing to write a book. It's another thing for it to be read and with such care. Sometimes people say, oh, I liked your book, but they don't seem to really have read it. And so for somebody of your intellect and attention to have spent so much time with it and with me, I'm truly grateful. And I thank you very deeply.
Well, that concludes this edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Again, if you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review. Thanks for tuning into this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you next time. So long for now.